It'll be first and 25.
This is First and 25, the Football Zebras podcast, our 25-minute roundtable discussion on officiating. This week from the Football Zebras crew, in addition to myself, Ben Ostro, we have Chris Soibert and Pat Weber. This week, we also brought in an alternate official, and we have Mike D'Ambrosio from the Whistle Talk podcast. So, gentlemen, we're going to jump right in with a few quick takes and take a look at what we have seen over the past week or so. And Pat, what was one of the things that came up this Thanksgiving weekend?
Yeah, one of the bigger and more controversial calls, I guess, that came out of the Thanksgiving Day games was the timeout, false start kind of fiasco with Matt LaFleur in the Green Bay Packers-Detroit Lions game. We've talked about this a few times before, how difficult red zone situations can be when it comes to coaches calling timeouts, because obviously the line of scrimmage is so far away from the team area. It is not always immediately apparent whether the coach is calling timeout or not. And the officials nearest to the sideline, you know, the short wings, referee and umpire, are all the ones who are locked in on the snap and locked in on the false start. And your deep wing in the corner of the end zone is really going to be the one identifying a late timeout or not. So in the Green Bay game, we have the right guard jump, commit a false start. There were three or four flags down, and all of a sudden we got a timeout. And on replays, it's pretty apparent that Matt LaFleur, the Green Bay head coach, called timeout after the false start. And it's a tough one for us, for the referees. I think the four that are locked in on the snap and the false start really can't see the timeout. And the deep wing who's seeing the timeout really isn't watching the line play. So we got kind of get put in a hard place sometime trying to decide which one comes first. And in this situation, unfortunately, the referees were on the wrong side of it, and the Packers caught a break and scored a touchdown instead of a field goal.
So I hear what you're saying, and I know you're going a little heavy on there. I want to kind of work back to how it gets sorted out really quickly, if you wouldn't mind. As you said, you do have the deep wings to give an assist, but you have an action that's on one side of the field being a timeout. You have the false start being on the other side of the field. And, you know, we could also have had an audio, we could have had that the signal from LaFleur was, you know, him yelling first before we see the visual. We're trying to parse this down, but, you know, you're on the field and you have all these elements and different people have them at different times. And it's trying to figure out where these things lie. Is it just getting to a point where you take the less severe option?
I think sometimes it does come to that, especially when we're talking, you know, the more common situation, which is delay a game or a timeout. And I think when it comes to delay games, we do want to err on the side of they called a timeout. This one's a little different, the false start, and we're going to have two or three officials with a flag down versus just a back judge delay a game, and then a deep wing has a timeout. And I think when you get together, it's just, it comes down to who's the most confident in what they saw. And I think really deep wing is going to lead that conversation more often than not.
And that's one of the things that I think common fans kind of miss, is that it's not the referee that jumps in and says, well, I'm the head justice here and I'm going to make a decision. It's getting your crew together and talking it through and trying to come up with the most equitable call. Let's send it over to our alternate this week. We have Mike D joining us, and tell me a little bit what you saw this week. I think you saw something in college this week that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. So first of all, thanks guys for having me on. I appreciate the invite to come on tonight. One of the plays that from this weekend with the Clemson Florida State game, got to give props to the deep wing official on this one. I think it was an 80-yard touchdown pass on a short little pass that the receiver broke down the sideline. And he looked like he got tackled on the 20-yard line. And the short wing was in great position. So mechanically, absolutely sound. The receiver ended up rolling on top of the defender, never going down, never having any body part touch the ground other than his hand to brace himself on the ground. So nothing, no shin, no forearm, no nothing like that, touched the ground. And the receiver got up regained his balance right down the sidelines, because he almost looked like he was walking a tightrope down the sideline, and ended up scoring an 80-yard touchdown on the play. Mechanically, perfect position, kept the whistle away, because a lot of people, especially when you're playing in Death Valley and you got that ruckus crowd going on there in Clemson, blowing that whistle, killing that play from what apparently looks like a great tackle and a touchdown saving tackle, but keeping that whistle down to his side, letting the play out, and in the long run made a great, great call with a non-whistle and let the play just continue to go. So got to give a shout out to that ACC crew in that one, and the deep wing in particular. Unfortunately, I don't have the names of that of the crew that worked that game, but just mechanically sound. And it's the little things like that we officials always pick up on that a lot of the casual fans don't typically see and notice and kind of take for granted. But he was right there, made the great call, and Florida State was rewarded with a touchdown.
And it comes down to not anticipating the call that is going to come before you. Everybody is expecting this to be a tackle, expected to maybe or even be driven out of bounds. I mean, it was, as you said, it was a tightrope, and just not anticipating that. I mean, we're talking about different speeds. He's at a full tilt run, and now all of a sudden everything slows down and then speeds back up again. So, you know, in that case, you know, not anticipating gets the job done. Unfortunately, we know that that's not all of the story. And so for the flip side of that, we'll go over to Chris Soibert.
For the referee's worst nightmare, we go to the Miami-Virginia Tech game. Third and 11, Virginia Tech down 17 at this point. So they're really trying to claw their way back in a game where they're being overmatched by Miami. Quarterback gets flushed. You know, he's retreating a number of yards. He's probably running backwards 10 yards. Miami defender wraps him up, wraps his legs up. As he's going to the ground, actually gets the ball off. He clearly gets the ball off. But you can see, and ultimately you can hear, as that quarterback is tackled after the release of the ball, the referee blows his whistle. And he actually, you can actually see from the video, he is flummoxed that the ball is not there. And unfortunately, this is kind of what you were alluding to, Ben, where I think he anticipated the ball still being in the possession of that quarterback. And unfortunately, that pass was a darn good one, because it was completed and they had actually converted that third and 11 for a first down. During that run, though, you can see some Miami players looking back because they heard the whistle too. So, you know, there's a chance, I guess, they could have gotten the receiver, but ultimately I think he would have ended up getting his first down, and there was nothing that crew could do other than eat that whistle, because it's a loose ball play. The only solution is to replay the down. Unfortunately, when they replayed the down, this time the quarterback did get sacked and ultimately killed that drive for Virginia Tech. And, you know, you can see the Virginia Tech head coach yelling at the officials, obviously, because he's obviously disgusted. And the referee is just like not even saying anything, because he knows he kicked the can on that one. And there's really nothing you can do at that point other than try to go back to your mechanics and delay that whistle as much as you can. And we all tell ourselves this over and over again, but sometimes we just find ourselves, especially as a referee, trying to protect quarterbacks, because you want to make sure everyone stops at that point. So you're really trying to make sure you get that whistle down so that quarterback could protect it. But this time it got that referee in the end.
And I think you hit where the issue was, is the onus on the referee to protect that quarterback. And yes, he's in a sack or in contact imminent. And so you want to shut that down as soon as possible before there's any kind of extracurricular. And in this case, the slow whistle is what was really needed. And unfortunately, killed that first down conversion. I just wanted to touch on one thing I saw repeatedly is the overtime coin toss. We're running into these situations where the captains are a little, you know, weirded out by the new options that are brought upon. The option to kick, which has been one of those things I thought should be taken out of the rules, now that actually is becoming a viable strategy for overtime with the two possessions. So here we have a situation on Sunday night, and called out by Pro Football Talk is Len Clark, that he botched the coin toss in overtime, which basically had Washington saying, we're going to kick that way. Asked him again, we're going to kick that way. And then Land Clark jumps in and says, you're going to kick. And the reason why he says that is because he got the options in advance. Because of these procedures that have come in with this new rule, we don't want the game decided on somebody not getting the options correct on a coin toss. That, you know, preventing them from making a mistake. Now, if they repeat a wrong choice, if they have a viable choice and it's wrong and you ask them again and they repeat it, if you have a viable choice, you go with it. But when you get two options, kicking and that way, you do have to jump in and give them the correction that you was needed. Because he got the options, it was also a smooth transaction on the other side. Denver wound up receiving that way, just as it was lined up. So it appeared that Washington took both options when, in essence, Denver did take the side of the field that they had wanted to begin with. And there was no objection from the captain either. So, you know, we're going to see this work around, but, you know, we got to see a little bit more from the broadcast crew, I guess, to explain what's going on in advance, or maybe even show the referee going to either sideline and finding out what the coach wants. We go back to Super Bowl 58, and Bill Vinovich knew who was going to get the ball first because he got the options. One wanted to kick, one wanted to receive. And so he knew before they even tossed the coin how this was all going to play out, which was a very unusual situation. Okay, so let's jump in with a couple of our topics this week. I wanted to quickly hit on a white hat substitution, which some parts of social media has taken as the white smoke of the papal succession. But Roy Ellison, the umpire, took the white hat from Adrian Hill, who had a calf injury. And so in that transition there, he dons the white hat, and now he's leading the crew. So basically, it's a reconfiguration. They practice this in preseason with a crew of six. So I kind of want to throw it out to you. I mean, obviously, you have a situation where your white hat goes down. You know, your crew chief, you know, the person who's your glue for the whole crew here, and now he's gone, and now you got to, not only are you playing short, but now you've got to move somebody else out of position to cover the white hat, and then anything that goes with being shorthanded.
I know in different sports, they have an extra official kind of in waiting in the background in case something like this does occur. Does the NFL not have anybody at all that could possibly jump in so that you're still staying with the same mechanics, even if it's obviously you're going to have to move? You can't have a person for every single position. You got to be flexible in that aspect. But you're going from a 7-person game to now a 6-person game. It changes our mechanics. It changes our keys, our sight lines. And like you said, they do practice it and they do go through scenarios like that. But wouldn't it possibly be beneficial for them to have somebody, an extra replay person in the booth or something like that, that can come down and possibly substitute for them?
Well, in that situation, I think that has been looked at in the past. And I don't think that there has been any push to add either somebody who's idle or, really, we would need to have a bench of 17 officials. Of people who would not get in the game or just make them 17 swing officials. And sometimes they're in, sometimes they're out. And it just seems to be an awful lot to add to the regular season. You know, when we get to the postseason, those games, obviously very critical. And then at that, we're with multiple alternates for, you know, wings and a white hat, and we would have like a back judge in there. And then by the time we get to the Super Bowl, we have a complete complement, an entire shadow crew. In fact, during COVID, they had one crew would stay in one hotel and the alternate crew stayed in another hotel so that they wouldn't even see each other until game day. So I think during the regular season, you know, we see some of the games where somebody goes down and they're out for a series or two. You know, so then you get somebody warmed up and in there, and then you got to pull them right away. So imperfect situation. I guess either way, it's an imperfect situation. And, you know, having somebody idle for most of the season to kind of trot out for that moment there, I guess they kind of, you know, weighed the pros and cons and decided against that. But and as you say, you wind up with officials out of position. In some cases, you sacrifice an umpire, so now you have a referee doing double duty.
Terry McCauley actually talked about that last point on Sunday Night Football last night when the umpire in that game went out for a couple plays, a couple series. It is always interesting, from an officiating standpoint, to me at least, to see who the smart players really are. And I know Terry kind of said that players really don't play any different. I think for the most part that's true, but I bet there's some pretty sharp players out there. There's at least a couple who know who's looking at what, and they know what they can get away with now and probably getting that extra tug in, especially when you have one person covering the whole offensive defensive line. You know, for me being a short wing, I have to imagine, you know, I know in the NFL, the passing game is much more complex than we see at the lower levels, but you probably want your line of scrimmage taking that tackle just a half a beat longer than they normally would when you have just the referee covering the entire line.
Yeah, Pat, maybe you can explain on the college side, because I know there are alternates at least, like when the Big Ten games that we're watching or whatever, I always see alternates on the sideline. And I'm sure, again, like you said, Ben, when it comes to like the lower levels, you're trying to get these alternates experience in these bigger games. So having them on the sidelines is useful, unlike the NFL, where, again, you know, you have kind of a committee of, you know, seasoned veterans already. And the NCAA, Pat, you know, do they have a referee and, like Ben said, all the other positions, or does it depend on the game?
I am not sure if every conference is the same, but the power conferences generally will have one official as an alternate. It's usually a development prospect who's probably kind of getting their feet wet, kind of seeing the game day process, aiding the crew a little bit with some administrative stuff off the field. But really, it's just someone that they're getting their feet wet. And I know one thing from hearing from some people have been alternates, you don't get a full game check unless you get in for a play. So you're not that you want anybody to get hurt, but, you know, getting in that one play makes the day a little better on the pay side.
And we had a situation a few years ago where referee Johnny Greer was in for the kickoff, and he had to be replaced right after the kickoff. Something happened, but we have a sense that it might have been green than anything. It was just maybe it was that game check thing, or I don't know. But
there's always been a few jokes. There's always a few jokes I've heard of having the savvy veteran on the crew, you know, get tight for a couple plays. Not that that ever happens, but I feel like on the lower side, I know losing the referee in the NFL is a big thing because now you have to do all the penalty enforcements, the announcements. But I feel on the lower levels, I think the one none of us want to go down most of all is the umpire, because nobody wants to get in the middle of the defense. And that's the one no one wants to move to.
And in the NFL, we wind up with each crew has a designated white hat successor on that crew. So that one is at least ironed out in advance as to who is going to be the one that takes over. And in this case, you know, we wind up with Roy Ellison, who stepped in. He had play clock issues. It was a one possession game. And, you know, he practiced for that moment, and he just stepped right in and did it seamlessly, as seamlessly as could possibly be. But you wind up with being down, you're off your game a little bit, but that's exactly the time when you have to be paying attention. So sort of related to that, but with a crew of seven here on Sunday night, we had a rough ending to the regulation period. A couple of calls that weren't there. There was a intentional grounding. There was a motion that converted into a false start because their clock was running. It was a little technical, if we were going to call it that way, and if it's going to be something that zaps 10 seconds off the clock. So after that, I had tweeted at the end of regulation, I said, you know what, this crew's got to get it together. And, you know, yes, this game may have gotten in front of them, but they have an overtime to get through. And it's just put that all out of your head, move forward and do this. And we've touched on this before, but just want to kind of get a sense of experiences on the field where you just feel like the game has gotten in front of you and you're trying to rein it in.
But one thing that it was ingrained into me, just coming up through the ranks, working sub-varsity games and stuff like that, even youth games, is to play each play or to officiate each play in the moment. And what's happened in the past, I don't want to have a makeup call. I want to have a call that I see, that I let marinate, and that I know is going to be a potential issue. So I don't want to let what has gone behind me affect what's going on in front of me. So yeah, we've got all been involved in those games where, okay, the game hasn't gone great, but do we let that snowball effect into it continuing? And like you're saying, going into overtime, you know, you got the overtime ahead of you, hit that reset button. I like to try to hit that reset button on each snap. I'm an umpire. I set the ball. I go back into my position, take a breath. Okay, next play is about to start, and I go from there. So it's just something that I've just tried to train myself into doing. I know everybody's a little bit different, but it's just a mindset that I have of not letting either a missed call, a bad call, whatever the call may have been, affect what I do on my next play.
Yeah, for me, and I think it comes a little bit from the U of M OSU game as well, as when it's a rivalry game or a really chippy game, you are on your sort of hyper focus to make sure you're catching all sort of the, you know, after the whistle sort of stuff. And if you start trying to look and see everything, you'll probably see nothing because you're just trying to capture everything. And you know, in a crew of seven or a crew of five or whatever, you have your keys, you have your dead ball areas to officiate. If you stay with those mechanics, it can get you through those sort of high pressure situations.
Yeah, I think Mike made a great point. When things are getting a little tough, maybe just taking that deep breath, being cognizant of the pre-snap routine, your pre-snap checklist, and just hyper-focusing on that and your keys, and just letting the game be the game and just refocusing on where our part is.
And on top of that, you're on a wing there, and you're probably hearing from a coach who feels that you were wrong, but may not even be your call. You're just hearing from something else, and you're getting pounded with all of this information. We had a clip a few weeks ago where the wing official is being told to watch the play clock by the Colts coach, and obviously not his key entirely. So that even comes into play. It doesn't even have to be that it's your miss or something that is in a gray area that's occupying space in your brain. You got a coach that's chewing you out about something that happened all the way on the other side of the field.
Yeah, I think a lot of coaches at the end of the day just want to be heard and know they're being heard, and kind of going through that communication checklist of letting them know that I'll say, well, we're watching it, even though, like, to your point, the play clock, I know my back judge is watching it. But as long as the coach is being acknowledged, for the most part, most communication is effective in that manner.
And I've seen this a lot more with baseball, and there was one exchange that was leaked a few years ago, which it was pretty much the part of the conversation that impressed me is like, did you get it out? Did you get it all out of you? You know, because you feel that you were wronged. You tell me, you do that. You don't go doing all sorts of other things. Diffuse the situation so that you can get the game going. Because if you keep him stewing, guaranteed he's going to come back at you with, you know, amplification every time any little thing seems to go wrong. Got a little bit of time left, 30 seconds or so. Mike, let's send it to you. Tell us a little bit about the Whistle Talk podcast.
Yeah, so my podcast is called Whistle Talk, Inside the Mind of a Football Official, where I interview coaches, other officials at all different levels, NFL down to high school levels, going over rules, going over different particular plays and things like that, and just trying to educate everybody, including officials, just getting back into the book and the rules book and mechanics, and just talking about football from a different perspective, and hopefully trying to continue to grow the game by maybe converting a coach to be an official, or at least maybe put a little sugar coat on top of that coach so they're not in Pat's ear on the sideline the whole time trying to buy calls. But just trying to educate and stay on top of the game and stay up with all the different nuances and just talking football year round and just keeping the communication alive.
Excellent. So you have two options to scratch the itch of your officiating nerdiness. It's the Whistle Talk podcast and the First and 25 podcast, both of which you can find them wherever you are, on whatever podcasting platform you prefer. You can search for it and find it there. We will also have a link on the episode page. And that does it for the First and 25 podcast. Please share, like this, get the word out. Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next week on First and 25.